Hi, this is Kira Lynch, and I'm the Superfund Tech Liaison in Region 10, and we're going to go ahead and get started on today's seminar. And I'm going to go over some brief logistical things first and give you, and then I'm going to turn it over to Tom Burbacher, who's going to give you the introduction of Dr. Andrew Maynard, who is our speaker today. So for CLUIN participants, when you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL. The CLUIN webpage there contains a short abstract of today's seminar with Dr. Andrew Maynard. If you are participating via the Internet, you should have clicked on the Go To Session icon near the bottom of the page and should be on slide one of the presentation. We recently updated the downloadable presentation. To ensure that you have the correct presentation, please verify that the presentation you are viewing has 60 slides. If you are not using the correct presentation, you will need to go to the presentation download page and re-download the presentation. So going on to slide number two. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, please mute your phone lines during the seminar to minimize disruption and background noise. You are currently muted and can press star 6 to unmute to speak and star 6 to mute again to listen. Also, please do not put this call on hold, as this may bring delightful but unwanted background music over the lines and interrupt the seminar. During the seminar, you will be cued to offer feedback and can submit questions as the talk proceeds. Today, questions from both the Seattle audience and the remote audience will be addressed at the end of Dr. Maynard's talk, for the most part. As you see, each slide contains a navigation bar across the top. To submit comments, questions, and report technical problems, use the question icon at the top of your screen. Navigation, you should move forward, backward in the slides by using the single arrow button. Left moves back one slide, right moves advances one slide. The double arrowed buttons will take you to the first and last slides respectively. You may also advance to any slide using the numbered links that appear on the left-hand side of your screen. The button with the house icon will take you back to the main seminar page, which displays the agenda, speaker information, links to the slides, and additional resources. Lastly, the button with a computer disk can be used to download and save today's presentation materials. For the purposes of our UW Superfund Remediation Program ongoing agency seminar series, we ask that the web and phone audience provide feedback to the University of Washington about this session. At the end of the talk, you will see a clickable link that appears, which takes you to University of Washington online feedback comment sheet. These comments are very important to us, and we use those in developing new sessions. So with that, I'd like to turn the session over to Dr. Tom Burbacher, who's the director of the Research Translation Corps for the Washington Superfund Research Program.
Thanks, Kira. I appreciate it. As Kira just mentioned, we would really appreciate at the end of this if you could do the feedback form that we have. It really helps us in planning our future seminars for the seminar series. We really enjoy doing this with EPA and Department of Health, Department of Ecology. So that feedback really helps out. So I'm very delighted to introduce Dr. Andrew Maynard. We spent the morning together. He's already given a talk at the University of Washington, so we're really pleased to have him here. Dr. Maynard has a bachelor's and PhD in physics, PhD from Cambridge, which I'm sure is a good background for the nanoparticles. He is a Charles and Rita Gelman Risk Science Professor in Environmental Health Sciences at the University of Michigan. He's also the director of the University of Michigan Risk Science Center. And we talked a lot this morning about his travels. It sounds like he does a lot of traveling, both national and international. And he's a member of the World Economic Forum Global Agenda Council on Challenges in Emerging Technologies. And as you'll see from his talk today, he's one of the leading authorities in emerging technologies. So with that, I welcome Dr. Maynard to the seminar series.
Great, thank you very much. I'm going to sit down if that's okay, not because I'm lazy, but because it prevents me from wandering away from the microphone here so the guys on the line can actually hear me. It also means that I can see my slides here. So I should also preface this by saying that I haven't had so much fun in preparing logistically for a talk since I spoke in India many, many years ago, where I actually had to handwrite each overhead slide before I gave it. It feels a little bit like that dealing with this online system, but I think we'll deal with that. But I should warn you, I'm not used to using this format, so there are going to be a number of slides here where you actually get the punchline before you get the story behind the punchline. So in those cases, I'm going to have to ask you to pretend you can't see what's on the screen and sort of follow through a certain line of reasoning. But we'll see how that goes. So for the people on the line, we're on slide 3 at the moment, which is just my introductory slide. So it's great to be here. I'm very glad that I was invited. And I was invited to give you a perspective on nanotechnology and some of the issues surrounding health and environmental implications of technology. What I actually want you to do is take you through some of my current thinking and current work in trying to understand what exactly it is we're trying to do here, what exactly the problem is we're trying to address, and what our options are for trying to address that problem. Because it seems over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of excitement over nanotechnology, a lot of concern over nanotechnology, but nobody's quite sure what the issue is that we're either excited about or concerned about. So we'll try and pick that apart a little bit. And I want to start with three very quick examples which highlight this issue of us not being quite sure what's going on. So if we move to the next slide, slide number 4. This will take you back about 18 months to the Gulf of Mexico oil disaster. When this disaster occurred and you had these thousands and millions of gallons of oil spewing out into the Gulf of Mexico from 5,000 feet below the sea level, there are many, many issues that arose. But something that most people probably weren't aware of was a story associated with the use of nanotechnology. So as the oil began spewing out, one of the big questions was, how do we clear it up? And if you cast your mind back to when people were looking at this issue, there are lots of possible options there, but the option that BP ended up coming back to was the use of a very well-established dispersant that it turned out people didn't really know much about, Corexit, which surprised a lot of people because there seemed to be a lot of other alternatives that were available but weren't approved for use. And one of those alternatives was a material, if you go onto slide 5, called G-Marine Fuel Spill Cleanup. So this was a product that was developed by a company called Green Earth Technologies. And it was a product that effectively used very, very small micelles, effectively small, soft nanoparticles that contained a biodegradable dispersant, which they claimed was more effective than conventional dispersants with a very much smaller environmental footprint. The only problem was this particular product wasn't approved for use by the EPA. And so the company, they claimed at the time they had stockpiles of this that were sufficient to clean up most of the oil spill. All they needed was the green light from EPA. Then they ran into a roadblock. And the roadblock was that a group of non-government organizations got wind of this and petitioned the EPA not to approve this particular product. And the argument in this petition was associated with the use of the word nano in the product description. So the company described this as a product of nanotechnology because they're engineering these micelles at the nanometer scale. The NGO saw this and they wrote this petition where they pointed out to the Environmental Protection Agency that manufactured nanoparticles have been shown to be toxic in humans, mammals, and aquatic life. Don't allow this technology out because there's uncertainty about its environmental and health impacts. This story was then picked up by a journalist writing for AOL Online. And as he wrote this story, he tried to pull the pieces together, but he ended up concluding that this was a potentially deadly technology. And you look at that quote at the bottom, and I just want to pull out the last bolded part of it. This is my bolding. And he wrote, as does asbestos, nanoparticles have been shown to cause an aggressive cancer called mesothelioma. So something very odd was happening here. A supposedly benign and good green technology was effectively nixed or stymied because people had fears that it might cause mesothelioma. And if you go back to, go on to slide number 6, so this is where you should suspend what you see on the screen because this is supposed to be a developing story. But you look at the top left-hand corner. What we started off with was these soft nanoparticles, particles with a limited lifetime which would disintegrate and disperse fairly quickly in the environment. That idea was conflated with the idea of solid nanoparticles that have got long-term persistence. That idea was then conflated with the idea of long fibrous particles, and there the association was made with the rather deadly cancer mesothelioma. But you had this very strange sequence of events going from a soft particle to a cancer which is in no way associated with either soft or hard nanoparticles. And we've got to ask the question, what on earth just happened? So think about that as I go on to the next little vignette here, moving on to slide number 7. So that was a case where there was misunderstanding and miscommunication leading to confusion. The second case deals with a nanomaterial which has been around for a number of years and which people become increasingly concerned about, nanoscale silver. 5 or so years ago, a number of companies started incorporating nano-silver particles into them to give them antimicrobial properties. And there was quite a lot of excitement about this, but at the same time there were growing concerns that this particular use of nanoscale silver could have unwanted environmental and health implications. So much so that the Friends of the Earth Australia came up with a report in 2009 calling for an immediate moratorium on the commercial release of products that contain manufactured nanosilver until a technology-specific regulation is introduced to protect the public. So a lot of concern here. But this concern wasn't only limited to non-government organizations. In fact, the Environmental Protection Agency has been funding a lot of research to the tune of millions of dollars in this area to try and work out what the environmental and health implications are. I actually tried to get some figures on what the research dollars are in this area, which proved impossible to get because this is research which is intertwined with other larger projects. But if you go on to slide 8, you can get an indication of how much research is going on in this area looking at these figures on the number of publications specifically focusing on nanosilver and environmental health impacts coming out since 2005. You can see between 2005 and now, there's been a rapid increase in the number of publications in this area, suggesting that there is actually a lot of research going on here, which is reasonable. You have an apparent new product going out on the market. Nobody's quite sure whether it's good or bad. We need to find out what the evidence is that suggests how it might cause harm. At the same time, our understanding of exposure to this substance is changing fairly rapidly. So if you move on to slide 9, these are 2 micrographs from a study that came out just a few weeks ago from the University of Oregon. And it's a study that showed that silver metal has got a propensity to naturally release silver nanoparticles into the environment in the presence of moisture. So this is a study that is still to be validated, but there is a strong indication that ever since as a society we have been using silver as a metal, we have not only been exposed to silver nanoparticles, but we've been releasing them into the environment. Every time we've used a jug that contains water that's made out of silver, so this is going back to pre-Roman times, every time we use silverware, knives and forks made of silver or plated in silver, we're releasing nanoparticles into food by the looks of it that we're then eating. Every time we wear a piece of jewelry which is made of silver, these results indicate that that silver jewelry is constantly releasing a stream of nanoparticles that we're being exposed to. So that, where does that leave us in terms of raising concerns about the use of this technology, plowing tens to hundreds of million dollars into research looking at its potential health and environmental impacts, where all the while this is a ubiquitous exposure? And I don't raise this to sort of deride the system because there are very serious issues here. I raise it because we can begin to see the questions of what is relevant here and what is maybe not relevant are very complex. And I want to go on to a third example, and this is slide 10. So this deals with definitions of nanomaterials for regulatory purposes, and this is an issue that I'm going to come back to a little bit later in the talk. If you go over to Europe, the European Commission have been trying to work out how they can define nanomaterials for regulatory purposes for some time. And just a couple of months or so ago, they came out with what they consider to be the definitive science-based definition of what constitutes a nanomaterial for regulatory purposes. And they're asking regulators in Europe to adopt this definition. Unfortunately, it's a definition which is based more on policy rather than on science. This is actually a quote that came out in April from somebody in the European Commission that was working on this, where they actually said that there is so much confusion here that at the end of the day, the definition of a nanomaterial for regulatory purposes would be a policy decision. Now think about that. Definitions are what you build regulations on. If there is no science in a definition, where does the science come into the regulation? The answer is it probably doesn't. So this is a movement which suggests that we're building regulatory approaches to a new class of materials where science has been factored out of the equation. So you take those together, moving on to slide 11. It's very apparent that we have what social scientists would call a wicked problem. We have a problem where a lot of different communities have got this gut feeling that there is a problem there. Nanomaterials present something which we should be concerned about, we should be worried about, we should be doing something about, but nobody is quite sure what the problem is. Nobody's even quite sure whether there really is a problem there. Their guts tell them there probably is, but they haven't quite worked it out. So this is an issue. If we're plowing ahead thinking about how to work out who's using these materials, how safe they are or how dangerous they are, and how to regulate them, if we're not even sure what the problem is in the first place, we're going to run into a lot of difficulties. And so we really, if we're going to make sense of this, we need to pull things apart a little bit and try and work out what the real issues are here so we can focus our attention on the real science-driven issues and maybe put to one side the issues which aren't driven by science. And so if we go on to slide 12, what I want to do is try and pick apart what some of the drivers and issues are here. And again, slide 12 is another one of these slides which really doesn't work when you put it all together. You can see a little bit of writing behind there. That little bit of writing, if you could see the slide in full, would say a cynic's perspective on nanotechnology. So I wanted to give you a perspective on nanotechnology, which I can guarantee you haven't heard before, but actually is very important in terms of working out what is maybe important here and what isn't. So you have to here use your imagination and imagine this slide being built up bit by bit as I tell the story of nanotechnology. And the story starts in the 1990s. So there's actually a symbol, the logo of the NIH hidden behind there that you can't see. But the story starts with the National Institutes of Health in the 1990s, where under the Clinton administration, any of you that were around and active in research at the time would remember the NIH was getting bucket loads of money. Their budget was increasing very rapidly year after year under Clinton. This was great if you were in biomedical sciences and health-related sciences. It was not so great if you're in any other sort of area of research. Specifically, if you were the National Science Foundation, this was very worrisome because the NSF saw their budgets flatlining while NIH's were increasing. So within the National Science Foundation, they started looking around for some new concept or idea which they could sell to Congress which would substantially increase their funding. And as they're bashing around ideas, people started talking about this new area of science and technology where people were beginning to work out how they could engineer stuff at a very fine scale and tap into some rather unusual properties at that scale. So this was a very real area of development in material science. It had been ongoing for 30 or 50 years, but it was really beginning to reach maturity. And as staff at the National Science Foundation began batting this idea about, they began mining the archives and they came across that. What was then a little known talk by Richard Feynman at Caltech in 1959. So the physicist Richard Feynman in 1959 gave this talk, I forget the title exactly, I'm blanking on it, something about room at the bottom. But it was a talk that basically asked the question, what could we do if only we could control where individual atoms and molecules were placed within materials? And it was a talk where he basically said if we had this level of design and engineering control, we could revolutionize the world as we knew it. The only problem was, at his time, the tools didn't exist to be able to do that. Now, it was an interesting thought piece, went absolutely nowhere in 1959, but as this idea of nanotechnology began to surface within the National Science Foundation, there was a clear link between Richard Feynman's ideas and where NSF wanted to go, and they pulled this out as evidence that there was something really, really important here. And I've got to be clear, this was an argument that was supported by the research at the time. So if you look at research that was going on back in the 1980s at IBM, they demonstrated that you could use a new range of instruments, scanning tunneling microscopes, to pick up individual atoms and place them in precise positions. So there at the bottom left, you see the IBM logo spelled out in atoms. So clearly technologies were developing that allowed atom-by-atom manipulation. We're also beginning to see a better understanding of how we could tap into somewhat unusual properties of matter when it was engineered at a very fine scale. So there you see on the left a vial of cadmium selenide quantum dots. These are semiconductor materials where the fluorescence of those materials is controlled by the size of particles and how the size of those particles affects the behavior of electrons within those materials as opposed to the chemistry of the particles. So there was beginning to be clear evidence from the material science community that by controlling stuff at a very fine scale, you could do some really neat things with it. So the National Science Foundation, they saw this happening. They saw the seeds of a really powerful idea. They got a number of agencies together and put together this report, which you see in the middle of the slide, Nanotechnology Shaping the World Atom by Atom, where essentially they made the case for massive investment in nanotechnology because it was the future. Forget about all this sort of biology health stuff. Nanotechnology is where it was going to be at. They talked to Bill Clinton about this. Clinton thought it was a great idea, supported it, provided a small amount of funding, and launched the National Nanotechnology Initiative in 2000-2001. Not only that, as Bush took over, Bush also thought it was a great idea. Because the argument was made, if you invest in nanotechnology, you're going to see a rapid increase in commercialization of this technology. It's going to lead to economic rejuvenation. We really saw that, didn't we? Not working at the moment. But the argument was made that there was a strong economic argument here, and that would lead to job creation. Congress bought it. They supported the National Science Foundation in this. They supported the foundation of the National Nanotechnology Initiative. And in 2003, Bush signed into law the 21st Century Nanotechnology Research and Development Act. So you look at that. The first thing I need to say is, as though this was an idea to sell the concept of greater funding for the National Science Foundation, there was real science behind it. And if you just look at some of the figures, you go on to slide 13, you just look at the number of papers being published in the area of nanotechnology, you've seen a significant rise since 1990. These figures only go to 2009, I think, but you can see in 2009, you're looking at something like over 60,000 papers in this area being published. A large increase there. And even if you look at funding levels, over the last 10 to 12 years, there's been a substantial increase in research and development funding worldwide into this area of nanotechnology. So at the time, this slide on slide 14 now was put together, we were looking at something like $18 billion a year going into nanotech research and development. It was an idea that really had traction if you evaluate it in terms of funding that it stimulated. But at the end of the day, I should go over the next two slides. So slide 15 and slide 16 just indicate where this is going. So last year, there was a report put together looking at the next 10 years of nanotechnology. This is slide 15. 450 pages of it, expounding how nanotechnology is going to revolutionize the world in which we live. Slide 16, you just look at some of the fields where people are speculating on where we're going to see commercial breakthroughs. And there are many of them. And all of these are based in some way on developments in science and technology. So there is clearly a lot of substance there. But if you go on to slide 17, you cannot escape the fact that nanotechnology is an idea, not a technology. In fact, if you look at it closely, nanotechnology is a brand. It's an idea with significant added value, which has been used, yes, to stimulate new research, yes, to get more research and development funding, yes, to get people thinking about different ways of engineering stuff to add value to products, but it is that value-added idea, not a specific technology. Just to expand on that a little bit, and again, the next two slides don't really work in this static format, but I'll go through them anyway. So slide 18. Think about what a brand is. So I've said nanotechnology is a brand. What is a brand? Well, here's an example of a brand. Lady Gaga is a brand. So if you think about the name and the brand of Lady Gaga, it's far more than the person and far more than the talent associated with a person. It's the whole package of how you add significant value to the talent of that person. And the brand is very powerful, and I'm not knocking brands here at all. They're extremely useful. So you look at the Lady Gaga brand. It's inspirational, except it used to be maybe it's slightly less inspirational amongst today's youth than it used to be, but certainly it has a lot of power to inspire. It grabs the attention, and this is the brand. This is the whole package that grabs the attention. It makes you sit up and look and think, and it's worth a heck of a lot of money. So you take those ideas and apply them to nanotechnology, they work very well. So forget that banner in the middle on slide 19 now. Just look at the outside. So you look at the nanotechnology brand. It's clearly inspirational. We've had people working in areas and working across disciplines and being innovative in ways that I don't think they ever would have been if this brand hadn't been out there. It grabs the attention. It grabs the imagination of people. People can imagine a different future associated with designing stuff at the atomic scale. And without a doubt, the nanotechnology brand is worth a lot of money. $18 billion a year in research and development is not small change. So that's great. It's great if you want to see innovation stimulated, you want to see new research and development, you want to see new ideas. But as soon as you begin to ask the questions, is it safe? Is it ethical? Or is it legal? You run into a problem, because now you're asking questions which are usually associated with a thing, of a brand or an idea. And this leads in part to the wicked problem we started with, where there is confusion between an idea and a very specific subject. So this is where nanotechnology definitely presents a wicked problem, where we think we know, this is on slide 20, we have a problem, but we're not entirely sure what that problem is. So we need to begin to pull it apart. So moving on to slide 21, let's see whether we can begin to reframe this a little bit. Certainly in my world, where I'm interested in human health impacts and environmental impacts, I tend to start from the process of thinking, what can cause harm and how can I avoid that, rather than starting from what's the technology and how is that going to cause harm? I'm more interested in preventing harm than starting from the technology itself. So you can begin to sort of formulate the questions that we're interested in these terms. So we can ask, how can we begin to address the potential emergent risks of substances that are complex, that we haven't really had to deal with before, that are dynamic, and I'll talk a little bit about that later, that change their behavior over time, that exhibit physicochemical form-related biological behavior. So this, from a health and environmental impact perspective, is the sort of thing I'm interested in. And if you look at this, there are a lot of questions there that are related to nanotechnology, but the word nano and the word technology does not appear in it. So this is a reframing that begins to look at what the problem might be, as opposed to the problem that the brand or the idea encourages us to think about. But getting to that, at some point we do need to think about what nanotechnology is. So if you go to slide 22, this is the National Nanotechnology Initiative's definition of nanotechnology, and this is what has really pushed the brand along over the last 10 years. The understanding and control of matter at dimensions between approximately 1 and 100 nanometers where unique phenomena enable novel applications. Great definition, but it causes real problems as soon as you ask the safety question. Okay, so we need to pull it apart and work out what is real here and what is relevant and what maybe isn't so relevant. So slide 23. This is a really quick deconstruction of nanotechnology from the health and environmental impact perspective. And you look at this, there are two aspects of this. There's looking at what's old and what's new. Because one of the things we've got to realize is if we're looking at what people are exposed to, there's a lot of nanoscale stuff that they've been exposed to for millennia. Just go back to that example of the silver nanoparticles. The evidence now suggests that people have been exposed to silver nanoparticles ever since they started using silver, 6,000-7,000 plus years ago. And we've got to somehow incorporate that understanding into how we approach and respond to new challenges. So what's our role? Well, first of all, generation of nanoscale materials is as old as the hills. Every time you burn something, you produce materials which have got a nanoscale structure, which means that we've been also exposed to these materials for a long time. But we've also been using these nanoscale materials for a long time. So you look at the top middle image there. This is the Lycurgus cup. It's a cup that dates back to Roman times. It's unique because of that red coloring. So this is glass. And under certain lighting conditions, it appears gold. If you illuminate it from inside, it appears red. It does that because the glass is infused with fairly precisely sized gold nanoparticles. Now, of course, when it was made, the people that made it had no idea that they were utilizing gold nanoparticles. What they knew is that they had glass with gold in it that had this very unusual property. But the fact is that people, whether they knew it or not, have been working with nano-sized materials for millennia. They've also been using nanomaterials intentionally for a long time. So you look at the top right there. This is an advert for a material made by Scusa, aerosil. Aerosil is a fumed silica. So if you look at it under the electron microscope, it consists of fused particles of silica, and the individual particles are around about 20 nanometers or so in diameter. This is a material that is intentionally manufactured because of its nanoscale structure. That advert there, if my memory serves me correct, I can't read it from here, dates back to 1949, when Degussa were advertising the use of what they then called millimicron scale materials. They knew that it was nanoscale. They intentionally made it to be nanoscale, so it had a certain range of properties. So we've been using these intentionally manufactured nanomaterials for rather a long time. Having said that, there are new things happening. So if you look at the bottom, starting from the left, what is new is the degree of control we have at matter at this scale. So you saw earlier that example of the IBM logo. We're very rapidly learning how to control matter at a very sophisticated level at the nanoscale. We're also learning how to tap into a number of rather unusual properties of the nanoscale. So if you look at the bottom middle, and this is slide 23, I can't remember whether I said that, you've got this issue of strangeness. I call it strangeness because sometimes it appears very strange where materials change behavior as you engineer them at this very fine scale. And they change behavior for a number of reasons. One reason is that you're altering the way in which electrons behave in those materials. And we've known that in material science and physics for many, many years. But what is changing now is we're learning how to actually utilize those nanoscale properties in macroscale applications. And then the bottom right here, we've got this area of sophistication. If you combine this idea of control and tapping into strangeness, we can begin to build very sophisticated materials. Materials that can have properties that change according to the environment they find themselves in or the signals that we send them. So that's actually a picture of a smart drug. A drug that has got multiple different properties built into it. So it's a drug that is designed to go into the body, to seek out cancerous cells, to attach to them, to tell a physician when that drug is in place, and then on receipt of a signal, in this case it was almost definitely a red laser, to release a therapeutic agent or to kill the cancerous cell or to do something like that. So engineering and designing at this very fine scale, we now have this ability to create very, very sophisticated materials. So that is pulling this idea of nanotechnology apart. We then need to start putting it together again if we can get an idea of what is important here from an environmental and health impact perspective. So if you go on to slide 24, this is beginning to reconstruct nanotechnology. And the first thing is to try and minimize the influence of this brand of nanotechnology and start focusing more on the science. So I prefer to talk about nanoscale science and engineering, because this is something that is real. There is real science going on at the nanometer scale, and there is real engineering going on at the nanometer scale. Okay, so if you go on to the next slide, 25, I thought for a second I got my animations back then. So slide 25, you can begin to sort of reconstruct and think about what is new, and this is really just re-articulating what you saw on the previous slide. What is new and what is important here is the dexterity with which we're manipulating matter around us. And in fact, this is a dexterity that is important in this context in the material world, but it's also equally important in the biological world and in the intersection between the two. We can now play around with stuff in ways that we haven't been able to do before. What is new is also exploitation, the way we're actually using this new knowledge to create new materials and new products. And finally, what is very new is this idea of complexity. So just to emphasize that, if you go back 50 or 60 years, we were in the middle of the chemicals, synthetic chemicals revolution, where we discovered we had a whole new suite of tools to invent and create new chemicals. The chemicals are relatively simple because if you've got a new chemical, you've got 6 times 10 to the 3 molecules, each of them is identical to the other one. What we're now doing with nanoscale engineering is we're creating not new chemicals, but new materials where we can build on that chemistry and we can build complexity in. So now we've got things which are infinitely more complex than the chemical they're made out of. That opens up the future in terms of what we can do in terms of new products, in terms of adding value to products, but it relies on this idea of a very high level of complexity within those components. Just to give you another example there, you think of something that you use every day, an iPhone or a car. They work, and they work as they do these days, because they're incredibly complex systems, everything coming together. We can now take that level of complexity and engineer things at an invisible level with that level of complexity. So we're not dealing with just discrete chemicals, we're dealing with highly complex materials. So going on to slide 6, still thinking about definitions. Here's an alternative definition to the nanoscale science and engineering. Playing around with small stuff to make big stuff work better. So this is really, when it comes down to it, what we're doing in this area. Now that we can actually manipulate stuff down at the atomic level, and remember, the properties of everything that we use at the end of the day come down to how individual atoms and molecules go together and how they work together. We can now manipulate that to make the stuff that we use every day work better. We can add value to stuff. And this is at the heart of this ongoing development of nanoscale science and technology. So a couple of examples there, going on to slide 27. This is just looking at a consumer products that are based on nanoscale science and engineering. Many of the trivial products, everything from antimicrobial socks that you can wear for several days without getting too antisocial, and sporting goods which have got higher performance because of the way they've been engineered, all the way to things such as electronics. Your iPod, your iPhone contains nanoscale electronics. In all of these cases, nanoscale science and engineering is being used to add value to products, taking a product or a material and making it work better because of the way that it's been designed and engineered. Another example going on to slide 28. So this is just giving you a sense of how one particular nanoscale material can add value to many products in many different areas. So here we're looking at carbon nanotubes. And this is a little speculative, but these are all areas where people are exploring how this one particular material can be used to add value to different products because it is both a nanoscale material, it is a material that has certain properties because of its scale, but also because it can be used in very sophisticated ways in new products. So here we've got everything from electronics to new medical products, either medical devices or even therapeutics, to looking at very strong materials, to looking at how you can develop very energy efficient desalination processes, all the way at the bottom left to somewhat speculative applications such as the space elevator. The idea that maybe you can throw a satellite out into space, tether it to Earth with an incredibly light and strong rope, and use that to send people up into space effectively as an elevator. It was a science fiction idea back in the 1950s. To be honest, it probably still is a science fiction idea. But agencies such as NASA are actively investing in materials such as carbon nanotubes to see whether they can actually create the first space elevator. So it gives you a sense of how this ability to engineer and manipulate stuff at a fine scale is being seen as a way of adding value to a brand new range of products. And at the heart of this, if you go on to slide 29, is this idea of design. So we're all familiar with the importance of design in things that we use every day, human scale things. This is just a trivial example of two kitchen implements that are made out of steel, a frying pan and a knife. And it's obvious to everyone that in terms of utility, it's not the material as much as how it's designed that's important. And even in terms of safety and risk, it's the design which is just as important as the material itself. A knife can cut a frying pan calm. The material is the same. Design is critically important when it comes to safety and risk. What we're now discovering is exactly the same applies down to the nanoscale, or the scale that we can't see with the naked eye. So you go on to slide 30. This is a series of micrographs of one particular material, zinc oxide. And you can see there that what we've got there is a combination of material and design. It's been designed and engineered in a myriad of different forms. And so you can begin to get the idea here that it's the design as much as the material that might both lead to functionality and also the propensity of these materials to cause harm in different situations. It indicates that when it comes to nanoscale science and engineering, we've got to think in terms of design rather than just size per se. So if you go on to slide 31, that brings us back to the idea of problem formulation. We've got an idea of what nanoscale science and engineering is about now, where the opportunities are, how we might begin to put together science-based questions on safety. How do we begin to formulate the problem that we need to address? Slide 32. I did want to come back and start from this formal definition of nanotechnology that's been developed by the National Nanotechnology Initiative and move on from there. So, of course, we think about nanotechnology and nanomaterials as a result of that, as working controlling matter at a scale between 1 and 100 nanometers. And as I said earlier, this, I think, is a problem as soon as you start thinking about safety. So slide 33 is a cartoon that's accompanied a commentary I wrote for Nature recently, where I actually made the argument that when it comes to understanding the potential impacts of nanoscale science and engineering and regulating the products of nanoscale science and engineering, definitions are not that helpful. And it's a great cartoon. I had nothing to do with it. They just thought it was a great idea. But this idea of somebody actually trying to wipe out the nano from in front of materials, because the nano actually confuses you rather than helps you. But I do want to begin to look at this. And I put up the National Nanotechnology Initiative definition because there are two ways I think that you can interpret that when it comes to looking at issues of risk and safety. So moving on to slide 34. This is the framing that most agencies and most researchers have taken. So they've taken that definition and they've focused on this idea of nanoscale associated behavior. And they've made the assumption that if you're engineering stuff at the nanoscale, so you see new physicochemical properties, you've also got the possibility of new biological behavior that can be harmful. The trouble is, with that framing, you begin immediately to make the assumption that size leads to novel behavior. So you begin to think that if you make something with a scale between 1 and 100 nanometers, you have a substance that because of its scale or size can possibly cause harm. As soon as you've made that assumption that size is important, you begin to go down the road of trying to regulate products and materials according to the size of their components. And worse than that, if you buy into this size is important idea, as new science comes along, you try and begin to fit the science into your assumption that size is important. And that is very worrisome. And that to me is actually shocking, and it's a shocking thing to say, but there is clear evidence that this is happening. So if you go on to slide 35, this is something which occurred fairly recently, and I mentioned earlier this attempt by European Commission to come up with a science-based regulatory definition of nanomaterials. So this is the definition that they published just a few weeks ago. That a nanomaterial for regulatory purposes is a natural, incidental, or manufactured material containing particles in an unbound state or as an aggregate or as an agglomerate, and where for 50% or more of the particles in the number size distribution, one or more external dimensions is in the size range of 1 to 100 nanometers. It is a definition which is solely based on the assumption that the size of something tells you whether it's likely to be harmful or not. And if you have a look at that, it is very, very hard to find clear scientific evidence that supports any of the statements made there or any of the assumptions made there. Going back to that original statement that I showed you earlier on, this is very clearly a policy decision. Somebody decided that nanomaterials were a potential problem, and they came up with a definition which they thought captured nanomaterials irrespective of what the science said. It's an indication of the science being manipulated to fit the assumption that size is the driving factor here. And in fact, if you look at that definition, there is absolutely no way that it'll fly. Not least because they've included any sort of nanomaterial. So the exhaust coming out of your vehicle, materials, nanoscale materials that are formed naturally in the environment, probably the micelles in the milk that you drink, all coming within this definition of a nanomaterial for regulatory purposes. But moving on to slide 36, there is a different framing that you can take here. And that framing is subtly different, but importantly different from the first one, and that is that we're interested in nanoscale science and engineering associated behavior. So we're interested in the behavior, the biological behavior of materials which arise as things are designed at this very fine scale. With this framing, things look very different because we then begin to start with the assumption that it's the design process that leads to novel behavior, not the size. So we're basically saying it depends on how you imagine something, how you engineer it, how you put it together, that leads to the possibility of new ways of harm occurring. Because of this assumption, we have the possibility of defining and regulating by behavior rather than what something looks like. So we can say if a new material comes along, if it shows a certain type of behavior, it indicates that maybe we need to think differently about it from a regulatory perspective if we're going to protect people, we're going to protect the environment. It also gives us the opportunity of actually developing ideas that are informed by science, rather than trying to bend the science to fit our ideas. Because if we say design is important and we're looking at new behaviors, every time the science indicates that there is a new range of behaviors or certain behaviors don't exist, we can actually adapt our understanding to that science. So this is, to my mind, a more relevant way of moving forward. What it does, if you move on to slide 37, is it reframes the challenge we face in terms of what I would call sophisticated materials. So materials that have been designed and engineered in a very sophisticated way. And you look at that, nano doesn't appear there. Nanomaterials in many cases are sophisticated materials, but from a health and safety and environmental impact perspective, I'm interested in anything which is being designed in such a way that it presents a new threat. I don't care whether you call it nano, whether it's a certain size or what. I'm interested in what it does, not what you call it. And this is a framing that allows you to be able to take that particular position. So what is a sophisticated material? This is on slide 38. I'm not going to read through all this, but this is from a review of nanotoxicology that was published by myself and a couple of colleagues, Martin Filbert and David Warheit, earlier this year, where we began to pick apart what we mean by sophisticated material. And if you just look at the last paragraph there, we describe these as substances that arise at the intersection of scientific disciplines and technology platforms and demonstrate novel and even time and context-dependent functionality based on their engineered and increasingly complex physicochemical structure. So again, you get back to the idea of we're designing things to behave differently and where that novelty leads to novel biological interactions, red flags come up that indicate we need to do something different when it comes to ensuring the safety of these materials. So if you go on to slide 39, that allows us to begin the process of formulating the problem that we probably should be focusing on. And this is just one first attempt to do that. So here we have the problem of developing approaches to understanding and addressing the novel health and environmental outcomes arising from novel mechanisms of action and harm that are associated with sophisticated materials, including, but maybe not exclusive to, those that have been designed and engineered at the nanometer scale. So if you start from that perspective, rather than assuming that nanotechnology and nanomaterials are harmful, you can begin to look at where we need to develop the science, where we need to develop the regulatory structures to ensure that harm is minimized. And moving on from that problem formulation, I want to have a look at a couple of aspects of where we move on from here. I want to start off by looking at this issue of definitions, because this is an issue which won't go away. So slide 40. What I would argue is this framing suggests that if we're going to make informed decisions on safety, we need to think less about definitions and more about a set of principles that allow us to identify where a new substance is likely to create new challenges and new problems from a health and environmental impact perspective. And again, this goes back to that review paper where we began to develop a set of possible principles that might be helpful here. And let me go through those. So slide 41. We came up with three criteria. The first one was criteria of emergent risk, which we described as the likelihood of a new material causing harm or in a manner that is not apparent, not accessible, or not manageable based on the current state of knowledge. So the possibility of a new substance or material presenting a risk that we're not well equipped to assess or deal with. A second criteria, because one criteria alone I don't think hacks it, is the criteria of plausibility. So we've got a filter that indicates where we've got a new challenge. The second question is that challenge a plausible challenge or an implausible challenge? Going on to slide 42. So plausibility, we said, in this context, is the science-based likelihood of a new material, product, or process presenting a risk to humans and environment. It's okay to speculate about how a new material might cause harm. That's the emergent risk. But if we're going to be informed here, we also have to look at the plausibility of that causing harm. It's no good going off the tangent on something which hypothetically could cause harm, but is never actually going to reach the environment or reach humans and really cause harm. Sure, so the question we'll get to this. The question was, are we considering this through the whole life cycle of a product? And the answer is absolutely. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a few slides' time. So the third criteria on slide 43 is impact. So if we're going to be making informed decisions, especially when we're dealing with constrained budgets, whether that's a policy budget or a research and development budget, we've got to think about impact. How large or how small is the impact of this material likely to be? If it's a really interesting material which presents an emergent risk, it's a plausible risk, but only two people in the whole wide world are ever going to be exposed to this, it's likely to be a low impact, and it's probably not worth spending hundreds of million dollars on working out what the precise risks are. So there's got to be this cost-benefit element to things here. So you can put those together, and this is really just the beginning of a process to explore this idea of principles. Slide 44, you come up with something like a set of principles that suggest that special consideration should be given to research in this case, but also policy decision-making, into the potential impact and oversight of materials, products, and processes that have plausible potential to cause substantial harm in a manner that is not apparent, accessible, or manageable based on the current state of knowledge. So we have the principle. How does this work? And if you go on to slide 45, you can begin to see how it might be helpful in filtering out new materials, sophisticated materials that warrant more attention from those that maybe don't warrant so much attention. So here are five materials which would probably be on my list of materials that I want to know more about. The first is materials that demonstrate what I would call an abrupt scale specific change in biological behavior. So designing stuff at the nanoscale, there are a number of materials we've come across now where as you change the scale on which they're engineered, you suddenly get to a point where you see a radical change in behavior. Go back to the gold nanoparticles with the Lycurgus cup. Gold is a material where if you have a large lump of it, it's gold and it's chemically inert. You form it into particles 5 nanometers in diameter, and in a liquid suspension they are red and they're chemically very active. There's an abrupt change in physicochemical behavior. What if there are materials that show a similar abrupt change in biological behavior? If there are, we need to know about them, because if we do the risk assessment in one domain and they're being used in a domain where they show very different behavior, we've got something wrong. Secondly, materials that are capable of penetrating to normally inaccessible places. And there's evidence that as you introduce materials below a certain size into the body, and if the chemistry is right, they can cross over normally impenetrable biological barriers, such as the blood-brain barrier or the placental barrier. If they can do that, and if they can do that because of their physical form as well as their chemistry, again, we need to know about it, because it raises the potential of somebody designing something which can get to places we wouldn't normally expect it to get, and yet we're not aware of that in the risk assessment. Thirdly, active materials. So now we're seeing the development of materials where we can actually switch on and switch off different behaviors. An example of that was the smart drug that I talked about earlier. So if we're beginning to see people exposed to materials, or we're seeing environmental releases of materials where in certain circumstances they can show a certain range of behaviors, and then they can suddenly flip and show us a completely different range of behaviors, we need to be aware of those, because if we do the risk assessment on the wrong set of behaviors, we're going to get things wrong. Self-assembling materials. Very quickly, there's research now on materials where you take two or three components together, you put them together, and they will automatically self-assemble into complex structures. In situations like this, we need to be able to work out how to do the risk assessment on those complex structures that will, in some cases, develop in situ, sometimes inside your body. If we just look at the individual components, or we do the risk assessment outside that specific context, we may be missing something. And finally, materials that exhibit a scalable hazard that is not captured by conventional risk assessments. So this is a category of materials that I grandfathered in a little bit. But it captures those materials where maybe we're looking at the wrong dose metric. So typically, if you're looking at dose metrics in a risk assessment, you're looking at the mass of material. It works incredibly well for chemicals. But if you have a material where its biological behavior is driven by its physical form, it may be that that behavior or its likely impact is driven by the surface area of the material, or even the number of particles of that material. If we're measuring impact in terms of mass, and it's particle number which is important, we're going to miss something vitally important here in our risk assessment. So we need to understand what physical aspect or what physicochemical attribute to the material is driving that biological response. So you take those principles and apply them to a number of things, and I did this almost as a thought exercise to see how those principles help make decisions on different materials. So this is another slide going on slide 46 now. Where there should have been a gradual build here, because you see the punchline before I actually get there. So suspend your belief and go through this line by line. What I want to do is I want to take five examples of nanoscale science and engineering and see how they stack up against these three principles: emergent risk, plausible risk, and impact. So you take the first one. I thought I'd throw this in. Grey goo, the idea, science fiction idea, that maybe someone somewhere could create a nanometer-sized robot, a little bit of like a virus, that could assimilate any material. It could take any material, it could deconstruct it into its individual atoms, and then reconstruct it into a likeness of the nanobots. So self-replicating nanobots. And the fear has been, over the last few decades, that if anybody did this, these things would just get out of control. They would assimilate everything. People, chairs, tables, buildings, everything into this grey goo. Life as we know it would cease to exist. Okay, so is it an emergent risk? Absolutely. If somebody did this, this would be a risk we've never had to deal with before. Is it a plausible risk? Absolutely not. It's not going to happen. Scientifically, it's just totally implausible. Impact, zero. So we can strike it off the list of things we need to worry about. Smart therapeutics, these smart active materials. Emergent risk, absolutely. We're now developing materials that don't fit into our conventional chemical paradigm when it deals with assessing their likely impact. Plausible risk, absolutely. People are doing this now. They're already going into human trials. Impact, yes. People are going to be exposed to them. We need to know what the likely impact is going to be, especially with therapeutics that are going to be widely used. Carbon-60 molecules. So carbon-60 is something very interesting. Carbon-60 is a molecule, and yet for some obscure reason, it's always counted as a nanomaterial. And I have no idea why. It's one of those things where it fits neatly into the brand, but it doesn't fit into the science. But again, it's one of those materials which is intensely studied in terms of its potential risk. So an emergent risk, I would say that's questionable, because we know how to deal with the risks of chemicals. We've got protocols for doing this. Is it a plausible risk? Yes, it is, because this is a new material that is being used in products already, people being exposed. Impact, if it's widely used, and it probably will be widely used, yes, there is likely to be significant environmental and health impact if we get things wrong. So this is a case where, even though it probably isn't an emergent risk in the way that I set out, it's still something that we should be aware of. Nanoscale silver, going back to one of my original examples, is it an emergent risk? Probably not, if we've been exposed to it for millennia. Is it a plausible risk? Again, I put a question mark there, but probably not. And probably not for two reasons. One is the evidence we have certainly on human health impact is that you need a heck of a lot of silver in your system in order to see any sort of serious biological response. The other thing is the evidence both for environmental impact and human health impact is that it's not the silver particles that are important in most cases, but the silver ions released from those particles. And we know how to deal with exposure to silver ions. So it probably isn't a plausible risk here. Impact, very hard to say. Some figures would suggest that we're looking at a resurgence of silver being released into the environment with an increased use of silver as an antimicrobial. Other analyses suggest that we're never going to reach the heights of the releases that we were seeing during the height of the photographic era, for instance. So it's very unclear whether this really is either an emergent risk, a plausible risk, or a high impact risk. And then the last one is nanocerium oxide, a material that EPA is currently investing a lot of money in trying to understand its potential impacts. So this is an interesting one because the biggest use of nanoscale serum oxide, which is likely to have significant environmental and human health impacts, apart from a couple of small examples, is in a fuel additive made by one company in the UK. The material is called Envirox. It's used in one or two places. It's used in the UK, used in a couple of other countries. It is not used in the States because EPA stalled on authorizing its use. And this is a material where you have these very small particles of cerium oxide. They're put into diesel. They help the combustion process, and they're exhausted pretty much unchanged as part of the carbonaceous material coming out of the exhaust pipe. Or, in the case of most diesel engines, they're actually caught in the particulate trap. So is it an emergent risk? Probably, because we haven't too much experience of people being exposed to precisely engineered nanocerium particles. Is it a plausible risk? I put a question mark there, but probably not. Probably not, because although we're not exposed to that much nanocerium oxide, cerium oxide is a fairly common material. It's there in the background. We're all exposed to it at a certain level. And the chances are, as it comes out of the tailpipe, it's not going to be in an easily biologically accessible form. High impact? Almost definitely not. There'd have to be a heck of a lot of this one product used for it to have a significant impact. So I actually think, putting it through the filters, that nanocerium oxide is one of those materials which doesn't raise half as many red flags as other materials here. But the point here is to show that you can take materials and you can put them through those principles filters and get an idea as to what might be more relevant from a regulatory perspective and a research perspective and what might be less relevant. Okay, so going on to slide 47, I want to begin to wrap up now, but I did want to look at a couple of other things, and I want to come back to this idea of novelty. Because up to this point, this idea of something being novel, something showing unusual behavior, has really been at the base of a lot of the discussion. The problem is, novelty is an incredibly difficult thing to get a handle on. So I want to talk a little bit about it. So slide 47 just puts up the Oxford English Dictionary definitions, in case you didn't know what real English definitions were of novelty. I guess they're fairly close to the Merriam-Webster definitions. But slide 48 is the important one. When we're talking about novelty and materials designed at the nanoscale and potential biological impacts, there are multiple domains of novelty that we need to be aware of. And again, this is a slide that really should be built up to build up the story so you get the whole package at once. But you start from the top left. First of all, there's the idea of novelty in physical and chemical and biological properties. Something is designed at the nanoscale, it behaves differently. It shows a set of properties that we can utilize commercially. That's a very clear novelty. If you're looking at biological interactions, there's novelty in some cases in terms of mechanisms of action. You can get some engineered nanomaterials that interact with biology in ways that aren't conventional usual. Maybe you can actually design particle which will pass easily through a cell membrane. Or maybe you can design a particle which will pass through a normally impermeable barrier. Or maybe it's a particle where if it comes into contact with certain proteins, because of its size and its structure, it will have a complex interaction with that protein. So mechanisms of action is definitely an area where we would expect to see novelty. Biological harm, harm to the environment, harm to species, harm to humans. That's a different domain of novelty, and a domain where plausibly we might see new harm arising from these novel mechanisms of action. And again, you've got the final domain of novelty, health outcomes and environmental outcomes. The possibility of having new diseases, new damage, new harm that you wouldn't normally expect. The reason I put these up is that there is a danger of assuming that novelty in one of these domains translates into novelty in one of the others. And in fact, I think there's a fairly clear relationship with them, but it's not immediately obvious. So go on to the next slide, slide 49. Again, this is a slide that desperately needs to be built up because you see the whole story at once. But the punchline here is the domain of physical, chemical, and biological novelty, properties novelty, is really big, all-encompassing domain. In contrast, the domain of health and environmental outcomes that are novel is a very much smaller subdomain. My good colleague, Martin Filbert, Dean of the School of Public Health at University of Michigan, has this habit of saying there are only so many ways the body can say ouch. You can put really esoteric things into it, but there are only a set number of ways in which we respond to that. You can say the same about the environment and environmental species. So in many cases, even though we've got something really novel out there, the chances of that actually translating into a novel health outcome or a novel environmental outcome are actually very slim indeed. It's obviously incredibly important if that is the case, and that's where we need to focus our attention if we're going to ensure the safety of these new materials that are coming along. But to assume that just because something shows novel behavior, it's going to lead to a novel outcome is a very dangerous assumption to make. So moving on to slide 50. It is worth just talking a little bit more about this issue of novelty and outcome, because I think this is important, and I think there are going to be some things where we do have novel impacts and novel outcomes. And to look at that, we need to get back to look at how we actually approach risk quantitatively. And slide 50 is another slide which should have been built up because you get the punchline. But the long and short of it is we're used to thinking about risk as a function of hazard, the potential for something to cause harm, and exposure, the amount of stuff you're exposed to. But with the sophisticated materials, there is a third parameter here which I think is becoming increasingly important, and that parameter is time. And I say that because we're now looking at materials that show temporal behavior, whether it's materials that are designed to be persistent so that they can carry on doing what they do for a long period of time. Heterogeneous catalysts are a good example, or the materials that can accumulate in the body or the environment. We're looking at materials that can physically transform. So this is something we're not really used to dealing with in terms of impact, where you have a material where its biological interactions are driven by its physical form, and yet it can be transformed into another physical form with a different set of biological interactions. An example might be the process of agglomeration, where individual particles come together into complex clumps. We may see a different set of interactions associated with the agglomerates than we do with the primary particles. Or you may have the case of weathering, as we saw earlier with the silver particles, where you have start off with fairly large silver nanoparticles, and they end up forming very much smaller silver nanoparticle daughters. Because the physical form has changed, we may have a different set of outcomes associated with different forms of the silver. So this transformation process may be important, and it's time-related because it happens over time. And then you've got this issue of activation, which I've mentioned a number of times. The possibility that we're designing materials which can radically change their behavior depending on the environment that they find themselves in or signals that are given to them. So again, we've got this issue, and this is time-related because it means that potentially their behavior and potentially their propensity to cause harm is going to change over time depending on the situation they find themselves in. This is where time, I think, becomes an increasingly important factor
in trying to work out what likely risk is going to be.
Right.
Okay, so you're right. So for the people on the phone, the question was, surely we've always had to deal with this component of materials. There's nothing new in saying that material creates new issues because it's persistent, because it transforms, because we have activation. And I would agree absolutely with this. However, I would also agree, I would also say that we're missing something here. So you look at how almost every agent is dealt with. It's dealt with in terms of its chemistry rather than its physical form, with one or two exceptions. And you could think of things like particulate matter or asbestos as exceptions where physical form is important. But those are exceptions that we've really struggled with. We still tend to come down to this idea of chemistry. So if you look at sort of standard tox assays, you look in terms of chemistry, you look in terms of things being static and not changing over time, and you look at, if anything, when it comes to transportation and transformation, you basically look at a chemical transformation where something distinctly changes from one thing to something else. So you deal with a different chemical entity coming out of the other end. With physical materials, I think we're still very early on in the process of working out how changes over time should actually be dealt with. So you take something very simple like agglomeration. So we deal with particulate matter. We really don't have a good handle on how to deal with agglomeration in particulate matter where you're having something that is changing from a distinct, very small particle to a much larger particle, which is an aggregate of smaller particles with a very complex structure. We have tended to lump all that together because we don't understand how to work out the distinctions between those two different physical forms of the material. And the same happens in a number of other cases. So I think as though we've got a framework where we're aware that these things happen, especially when you look at persistence and accumulation, we're not well enough aware to understand how to take an informed approach where physical form matters and physical form changes over time. So it's a long way of saying that, yes, we have been thinking about this, but we still don't have the tools of actually dealing with it, and especially where we're dealing with increasingly complex material. I hope that wasn't too...
Endless argument between chemistry.
Right. And to me, that is the basis of it. It's moving away from the physics-based sort of chemistry-based paradigm to a paradigm where physical form becomes increasingly important and chemistry becomes less important. But yes, we can argue about that a little bit more later. But moving on to slide 51, because I've got to get through these. Again, this is a slide which really doesn't work when you see it all at once, because it's a very complex slide and needs to be unpacked. But what I want to do here is to try and work out how you begin to take that idea of novelty, and especially how things might behave differently in different contexts over different time periods, and how you begin to develop a conceptual approach to dealing with these new materials. So the idea here was, if you start from the impact arrow, we're interested at the end of the day in understanding how new materials are going to impact on the environment, on people. Feeding into that, we need to understand how products going to the far left are going to interact with biology, leading to that impact. So that's a framework that we're fairly familiar with. You start with a product or material, it leads to we have biological impact interactions leading to impacts. We need to work out what is happening down that chain. And then, of course, once we've understood that chain, we want to minimize impact, we want to minimize risk, increase safety. So we look at how we can intervene in that process. And increasingly, as we're taking a life cycle approach, we look at interventions at each level there. We look at interventions at how we actually develop the products in the first place, looking at ideas such as green chemistry. We'll look at how we can intervene in terms of biological interactions, how we can prevent exposure, for instance. And we look at how we can intervene at the impact level. If somebody gets exposed to something, how can we reduce the potential implications of that? But the thing, when we start thinking about time as a factor here, and life cycle, that becomes increasingly important is context. So in each of those areas, looking at the products, looking at the interactions, and looking at the impact, we're going to have different contexts, whether that's the context of manufacturing in the workplace, whether it's the context of using a consumer product, whether it's the context of disposal. So we begin to get this fairly complex landscape within which we need to work if we're going to work out what is important here and what we need to address. And then the broader context of that, if you look at the next level out, we need the tools to be able to both understand what is going on in terms of the context and the possible interventions, and we need the tools to be able to enact certain interventions. And then taking one step further, we've got this this sort of varying landscape of doing the research so we develop our understanding of what's going on, but then we work out how to actually apply that understanding to take action, moving from sometimes fairly basic research to very applied research. So this is a sort of fairly holistic framing of the sorts of things I think we need to start thinking through as we begin to look at some of these sophisticated materials. And the next few slides, I tried to capture this, and this looks awful when you don't see it built up. So going on to slide 52, it actually looks like a Monopoly board here. But let me try and walk through it very quickly. So I want to capture this idea of as working in a very complex environment where we need to take a very much more integrative approach to understanding what likely impacts are going to be. So you look across the top, you've got there, and this is a very informal representation of different parts of the life cycle of a product. So life cycle is important here, but it's only one part of the equation. If you look at the left-hand side, you've also got different categories of products. So clearly, the impact of something is going to depend on which type of product it is, whether it's a pesticide, a catalyst, a medical device, food product, or whatever, and which part of the life cycle you're looking at it in. But then, even within those product categories, there are different forms of products, different forms of materials, and the form is also going to influence the likely impact. So on the right-hand side, you can possibly be dealing with everything from composite materials, where everything is closely knitted together, to mixtures, to aerosols, to powders, to pellets, a whole range of different forms. And then at the bottom, you've also got a broader range of contexts to think about. So are you looking at the designed use of a material? If you're looking at therapeutics, for instance, are you looking at off-label uses? Are you looking at how environmental conditions might impact on the impact of that material? Are you looking at the media that it's in, whether it's in the air, whether it's in soil, whether it's in water? There are a number of different contexts. And you begin to realize that if you're going to make sense of how sophisticated materials are going to lead to specific environmental and health impacts, you've got to be able to work within this complex set of conditions. How you actually do that, I don't think anybody has cracked yet, but just to emphasize how significant this might be, you think of something like carbon nanotubes, and you can think of a range of different scenarios which will lead potentially to a range of different impacts. So you can think, for instance, if you look at slide 53, of carbon nanotubes that are used in a consumer product. Maybe they're used in the composite that forms the frame of a bicycle. And you can think about their use as they're designed to be used. You can think about how people might be exposed to this material as they're handling either the raw material or the composite material. And if they're handling the raw material, you can think about the exposure in terms of aerosolization of that material. So a fairly specific set of situations under which exposure will occur, impact is likely. But you could also imagine different scenarios. So imagine you're still looking at consumer products, you're handling the material, it's in aerosol form, but you're dealing with it under a different set of environmental conditions, which may determine the exposure route and the nature of the exposure, whether you're dealing with discrete small particles of carbon nanotubes or very large aggregates, for instance. Or you can imagine a different set of conditions, again, consumer products, but now you're looking at end of life where, say, you've got this bicycle frame with the composite, where you're disposing of it. So different set of situations. You're perhaps looking at the influence of time over this. The bicycle has been used for some time. The material might have changed over that time. You're dealing now with a complex mixture rather than just an aerosol or a composite. So again, you can begin to see, you start off with one material, one nanomaterial, but its likely impact and the way we've got to think about that impact changes quite dramatically depending on a number of fairly complex and interrelated factors. So where does that leave us? Last slide in this presentation, I think slide 56. I've come a long way, and I have this fear that I've probably made the waters muddier rather than clearer here. But that's important, because if we start off on the wrong track with any sort of new area, including nanotechnology, and we don't stop and re-examine where we are, even if it muddies the water, we're likely to get out of whack with reality very fast. So I tried to sort of pull together one or two things which I think are important here. I'm not sure how much they clarify things. The first is, the more I look at this, the more I think from a health and environmental impact perspective, we need to think in terms of sophisticated materials and not nanomaterials. From a health and environmental impact perspective, I don't think there is anything particularly special about nanomaterials, but there are going to be materials that people produce and use that do raise new challenges, and we've got to work out how to identify those and address them. Secondly, I do think, the more I think about this, that we need to reframe potential health and environmental impacts in terms of design rather than science. It's design which really typifies where technology with materials is going in this area. And if we can think about design and how design leads to new risks, I think it'll help us frame this issue in a far better way in terms of applying science and evidence to both problem formulation and problem solution. Thirdly, we should formulate problems that are grounded in science, based on evidence, and responsive to new information. It's fairly self-evident. We need to start with the science, we need to start with evidence, and importantly, as new evidence comes along, we need to be able to adapt to it fast. It's no use putting our stake in the ground and saying this is the direction we're going to follow come what may, because the science is changing incredibly fast, and we've got to find ways of responding to that. Think again about the example of the nanosilver shedding off even smaller nanosilver particles. People that started researching this area 2 or 3 years ago, if they carry on saying, because we thought 2 or 3 years ago that nanosilver was a unique exposure that we never experienced before, we're going to carry on doing that, it makes no sense. Somehow we've got to be able to adapt to new knowledge. Next, we need to develop an integrated perspective on potential impacts within diverse, complex, and dynamic systems. This, I think, is important. We've got to get away from this idea of straitjacketing ourselves in terms of how we approach problems, and we've got to think in a far more holistic way, a far more systems-based way, because so many things are interrelated and interconnected here. And finally, don't get confused between brands and products. The nanotechnology brand is a great brand, but if you're making regulatory decisions, if you're trying to protect people, trying to protect the environment, a brand is not a good place to start, and we need to get away from that trap. Well, I did have one final slide, which EPA in its wisdom decided was not appropriate for this audience. So I'm going to have to describe it to you. Because going through this, I was aware of putting this together that it might come across as me seeming a little down on some of the risks associated with nanomaterials and these new materials. And I want to emphasize that very much isn't the case. And I think that there is a very real issue here of scientists and engineers developing new materials that could plausibly present very real human health and environmental risks. So the issue I want to raise is there are important questions to ask here, but we need to make sure we're asking the right questions. So the slide that I was going to put up is a slide of a bunch of naked people. People in the you in the room have got this slide in your handout. People on the phone almost definitely haven't got this slide. But it's a photo that was taken of a protest outside Eddie Bauer back in, I think it was 2003-2004. And it was at a time when Eddie Bauer was just introducing a new range of clothing that used a new, supposedly, nanotechnology to create stain-resistant, water-repellent clothing. It was actually a self-assembling monolayer, or I think it was actually a bilayer, of a particular polymer on this clothing, nanometers thick, obviously, designed to not affect the actual feel of the clothing, so you can put it on silk, for instance, and it still feels like silk, and yet it leads to quite incredible stain-resistant properties. The particular group that were protesting they didn't like the idea of Eddie Bauer using unproven nanotechnology, a new technology where there was uncertainty over the risks and benefits. And it was a group that did their thing by sort of stripping down and parading naked in front of things that they didn't like. Ironically, this particular protest, you look at sales of this nanotech enabled clothing afterwards, sales actually went up. Because as this hit the headlines, people looked at it and they saw naked people. That's interesting. Stain resistant pants. That's even more interesting. Got to get some of those. But the reason I put it up is to emphasize that there are important questions here. We won't always get the questions right. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be challenging the system and asking questions. But the real trick here is making sure we go back to the science, go back to what we know, and formulate the right questions rather than get all tangled up in the wrong questions. If we do that, I think we can actually put down a very strong foundation for seeing some really exciting new materials come along that are also safe and sustainable materials. Thank you very much. And I guess we have time for questions.
We do. And before we move into the question and answer period, I just want to go over a couple more logistical things that we have. So before we open for the question and answer session, the presenter, I wanted to make sure everyone is aware of the links page, which is on the next slide on your presentation, and the online feedback form. As we said earlier, we really appreciate getting the feedback. On the links page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely so that you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out that online feedback forms. We have two forms, and one is specifically for the University of Washington, and the other one is for EPA. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. Links to the additional resources page and the feedback forms can be found on the last slide of the presentation, and this presentation will also be available on the University of Washington Superfund site. So with that, I think we're going to open it up to questions in the room first. Does anyone have any questions?
Yeah, so the question related to asbestos, saying specifically that current work indicates that it's the surface area of asbestos, or surface area is one of the important aspects of asbestos. So I absolutely agree with that. So the best way of framing this, one of the challenges we've had with the focus on the nanoscale nanotechnology is this assumption that something magical happens at 100 nanometers. That above 100 nanometers, everything is hunky-dory. Below 100 nanometers, things go wacky. Whereas the reality is, we're actually dealing with a continuum. We know we're dealing with a continuum when it comes to surface area mediated effects. So you take a substance such as titanium dioxide, and you can see from inhalation studies that there is a very clear relationship between the potency per unit mass of the substance and surface area, from large particles to small particles. It's not unique to the nanoscale, it's just that smaller the particles get, the higher the surface area gets, the higher the potency gets. The same sort of thing is happening with asbestos now. So in a sense, it doesn't matter how thick or how thin the fibers are. All we know is that there is a relationship there, whereas you increase the surface area, you also increase the likely interactions and potency. If you start from the perspective that physical form is important, doesn't matter how big or how small, physical form is important, it's very easy to begin to examine that, because then you say anything that can get into the body that has an appreciable surface area, such as asbestos fibers, is likely to be a cause for concern. And you don't get into this issue of saying, well, is it above a certain size or below a certain size? The danger we've seen with nanotechnology is people have tried to sort of say something abrupt happens at 100 nanometers. So even if surface area is important, we can ignore it at large particle sizes and we need to take care of it at small particle sizes. That just doesn't work, again, because it's a continuum. So it's a long roundabout route for saying that what is happening with asbestos, I think, is indicative of our increasing understanding of the importance of the physical form of things that get into the body. And if we focus on physical form and don't get tied up with specific definitions of what is important and what isn't, we can make science-based progress. That makes sense.
Yeah, although I have to disagree. At some point, I've
that was the second part of, your point, which was that size can actually influence where things get, effectively. So again, a critically important point and something that has been missed with this obsession with nanotechnology. So if you look at definitions of nanomaterials which focus on physicochemical novelty, they cut out a lot of materials which are potentially important, because you take something like asbestos, good example. The difference between an asbestos fiber that can be inhaled and reach the deep lung and be transported to the outside of the lung, as opposed to one that can't, is purely a physical difference. Predominantly a physical difference. So you're not seeing any change in physicochemical properties, you're seeing a change in just the physical dimension. And yet, the likely or the potential health impact is profoundly different between the two. And so I would argue that from a material standpoint, we need to be aware of how changes in physical structure actually influence how things can get to different parts of the body, irrespective of whether they demonstrate a new range of chemical properties or physical properties associated with that change in size. And so again, it's a distinction between getting tangled up in the nano and actually looking at how a change in something leads to a change in its likelihood to cause harm.
On the ecological side, this is a probably different kind of question, but what are your views on dissolved versus cartridge?
Okay, so the question was on the ecological side, what are my views on the dissolved versus particulates and side of things? They're two different phases of material, obviously. If you're dealing with a solution, either ions, or if you're dealing with an organic solution, you're dealing with a very different phase than if you're dealing with suspended particulates. The dynamics are different between the two, the interactions are different between the two, the transformations are different between the two. However, there is obviously a very close coupling between the two. So you take something like silver, and you'll end up with some sort of equilibrium between some particular phase and the ionic phase, unless you've got certain sort of chemical reactions which will sequester the silver. But I do think that you have to be careful not to assume, and it's hard to sort of see how to parse this out, but you have to be careful not to assume that the particular phase is going to behave in the same way as the dissolved or the ionic phase. I don't know whether you want to expand any more on the question there.
No, that was a great answer. I'm thinking a little bit differently.
Okay.
We go into the environment and we think about chemical concentration.
Right.
We make measures of
Okay. So if you look at the question of concentration and how you measure it, obviously most techniques we have will just tell you the mass of a particular element chemical in the environment. It won't distinguish between the dissolved phase and the particulate phase. That's a problem if the particulate phase is important. And one of the challenges we've had within the sophisticated materials risk community for some years now is how do you actually measure the particular phase of something in environmental media, such as soil or water? In water, we can begin to do it. In soil, nobody has really come up with a good solution yet, in part because soil is packed full of nanoscale materials. But if the physical form is important, we clearly need a new suite of instruments which can distinguish those particular materials based on physical form as well as chemical composition.
We'll go ahead and see if there's, are there any questions on the phone lines? Okay, so, we don't have any unanswered questions on the simulcast, so let's go ahead and continue taking questions from the room.
I just want to go back to the whole idea of sophisticated materials versus non-sophisticated materials. So, I think the issue of size is an issue that in the regulatory community, especially in the air quality community, has been started regulating particles at PM10 size, and now we're really regulating particles at the nano size, small micro-nano scale size, because of the issues that you both discussed earlier. However, these are not engineered particles for the most part. They're just probably the most simple particles.
Right.
Which, it seems to be odd, you would not include in your, if I follow your presentation, you would not include those in sophisticated materials, so they do present very real risks.
Yep.
So I'm just curious why you're taking this approach.
So the question was, we're being exposed to complex materials from either natural causes or incidental materials. Why am I not focusing on those as well as the engineered sophisticated materials? And it's an extremely good question because it's something that I lay at night asking myself. And in part because I am coming round to thinking that it's actually dangerous to make the distinction. There are some arguments for making the distinction, but they're not strong arguments. One argument for making the distinction is, I think very clearly, we need to equip ourselves to deal with new materials that people are imagining and inventing and starting to use that we haven't had any experience of before, because there is the possibility that somebody will invent something that does represent a plausible health and environmental threat, and really we need the tools and the understanding to deal with that. Having said that, from a health and environmental perspective, we're interested in impact rather than technologies and materials. So as a community, we're really interested in anything which is going to harm people or the environment, and that we really don't have a good handle on preventing that harm. Whether that's coming from an incidental source material, whether it's a naturally occurring one, or it's something that's been precisely engineered. And on top of that, we're beginning to see a lot of commonality between stuff which is incidentally produced and stuff which is intentionally engineered. So the area between them is being blurred. And my sense is, moving forward, we actually need to develop a more sophisticated understanding of how to deal with these materials where the physical component of the material, the physical attribute of the material, leads to certain biological impact, irrespective of the source. And so although I focus on sophisticated materials from the engineering perspective, because this is what's coming out of technology innovation, I actually think as a risk community, we ought to step back and ask the question, where are people being exposed to materials where the physical form and the chemical identity of those materials is leading to a certain health impact, irrespective of source, and how can we develop a science of that which we can then apply in different areas? But that's a fairly sort of new route of thinking, and there aren't too many people thinking in that way at the moment. I think that's something we probably need to build up. Yes, here and then here.
I'm going to change my hat from hard-nosed engineer to naturalist.
Right.
Because this question was posed to me just 2 weeks ago. So, let's assume that you actually manufacture engineer that most of I need a full possible from. You planted to be in an area which is also an area that has shown
Right.
But 5 years later, you come back and you find out that it did so well that it has taken out all of the natural because it competed so well. We have that happen now all the time.
Right.
One of the biggest arguments that we have, I don't know if you're from Washington, you've probably been in Washington State for a long time, but we have this raging battle going on in the south side of Puget Sound because of buoy deck harvesting that's going on for their farm, and it's creating a problem with the natural.
Right.
That's the concern that I hear from naturalists who are worried. We have a tendency to think in terms of let's make sure that we look at all of the risks, but really what we're looking at are really chemical risks, biological risks, not necessarily spatial risks or competitive risks.
Right.
So I think that that's a valid question, so I'm bringing it to you.
I think you're right. So the question was, what happens if you develop what seems to be a completely benign material and introduce it into an environment, an ecosystem, but it actually alters the balance of that ecosystem. So it has effectively it has systemic impacts, which could be predicted if you take a very narrow perspective of this assessment.
Okay. But
yes. So just a question back to you. This is obviously something which is prevalent when it comes to biological species. Are you aware of equivalent issues if you're introducing inorganic materials to ecosystems? And there was a question mark sort of indicated back there.
Yeah.
So I actually think it's a really intriguing question. And it's an intriguing question because the more we look at the environment, the more we realize that nanoscale materials are integral to that environment. You take any ecosystem and sort of look from the minerals and soil upwards, everything fundamentally sort of works and operates and integrates at the nanoscale. And in fact, geologically, you can begin to see long-scale geological processes and loops, feedback loops, which work at the nanoscale in terms of nanoscale materials being formed and then subsumed. So then the question actually becomes quite relevant. If we develop a new nanoscale material and introduce it to those systems, does it somehow change the balance, which is going to have a number of knock-on consequences? I have absolutely no ideas as to what the answer to that is, but I would say that as we try and think more holistically about risks and benefits, it's something that we probably should be thinking about. One thing that is becoming increasingly clear is that if we think very narrowly in terms of risk assessment, we're going to miss something big. And especially as we begin to realize how interconnected things are in the environment and also how interconnected the world is, if we don't think systemically, we're going to make some really big mistakes. So I do think it's a relevant question.
Well, that's why, you know, your slide that you have, the questions, you know, Mark, make the decision of which ones are really the priority.
Right.
I don't see in there that type of risk.
So the question comes back to my sort of three criteria and the sort of slide where I was checking the criteria out. In my defense, I would say that this is just the first cut of a straw proposal which really needs to be developed. Having said that, if you look at the areas, in fact, if you look at all three criteria, emergent risk, plausibility, and impact, I think each of those can be developed to take a much broader perspective of what we mean about plausibility, emergent risk, and impact. That could actually incorporate some of these holistic impacts, effects.
In our traditional testing for toxicity, basically chemical type, it often takes 6 years before any kind of results show up. So I would imagine we would need different testing methods for nanotechnology, and how long would it take before we could begin to develop that toxicity or other issues?
I, So the question is, with conventional assays, if you're looking at hazard in particular, it sometimes takes several years before we have a clear sense of what is harmful and what to do about it. So how do we cope when the development cycle is far faster than our testing cycle? I don't think it's a question which is limited to nanomaterials, because if you look at synthetic chemistry, or you look at areas such as genetic manipulation, our ability to actually change things and produce new substances, new stuff, is just accelerating in almost any field, and we don't have the risk assessment tools to keep up with it. So yes, we're ending up with this widening gap between things that people are either making or introducing to the market, and our ability to actually test them. How do we close that gap? There are a number of things that people are exploring at the moment. Most obvious one, and the closest one to conventional tox testing, is looking at high throughput screening. And so the idea there is that you have a system which will at least flag up where you've possibly got a problem by carrying out 10, sometimes hundreds of in vitro and acellular assays in parallel on new substances, and many, many new substances. So you can maybe put hundreds of potential new substances through these hundreds of assays very, very quickly and develop profiles which indicate which substances are likely to be a real headache you don't want to look at, which substances are likely to be benign, and which substances you can actually engineer at a very early stage to push them more towards the benign rather than harmful stage. So that's a process which I think complements more conventional tox testing, but at least it pushes you on the right track, so you're less likely to make mistakes, and you're less likely to get to the end of your 4-year, 6-year process and decide, oops, I made a real error there. But at the same time, I think that's got to be coupled with different ways of handling information and making decisions. It seems to be inevitable that we're going to have to be making more and more decisions in the face of fewer and fewer data points and more ambiguous data. And we need more sophisticated ways of doing that, whether it's ways of bringing together information from very disparate sources and finding complex algorithms that allow us to make sense of it, whether it's working more on comparisons with what we know and applying it to what we don't know, or using expert judgments. But very clearly, we don't have the luxury of pushing things through these very long, laborious tox tests in the way that we've done in the past. Of course, one other aspect of that is maybe we need faster, more effective tox testing. And of course, that's a very active area of research at the moment, but a very contentious and very complex area of research, because at the end of the day, you've still got this argument that if you want to know what happens in humans, ideally you need humans. If you can't get humans, you've got to get the closest thing to humans in terms of your animal models. If you can't do stuff in animals, no matter what you do in vitro, you're still likely to be missing something, because there are very artificial systems. And animal tests and epi studies take a long time and a lot of money.
So can we go ahead, and I've got one question for you here on the internet. The question is there an existing regulatory framework onto which future regulation of sophisticated materials would be a reasonable fit? For example, PASTA, FDA medical product drug approval, or would you envision the need for an entirely new framework?
So let's take the end of that question first of all. Do we need an entirely new framework? No, I don't think we do. Simply because, just because we're developing new materials doesn't mean we need to scrap everything we've got at the moment, all the way from drugs and food to chemicals. It makes very little sense. On the other hand, if you ask, does the current framework work with these new materials? The answer has to be, in some cases, no, it doesn't. In some cases it does, and the trouble is we've got a really complex patchwork of regulations here. So regulations associated with new drugs, for instance, is very different from regulations associated with new chemical substances or regulations associated with dietary supplements. Just taking those on the drug side, because the regulatory process at the end of the day looks at effect or impact rather than technology, the chances are that the regulatory system there is pretty robust when it comes to sophisticated materials, with one or two exceptions. On the other hand, if you're looking at new chemical substances,
the indications are that Tosca is broke. But I think Tosca is broke irrespective of whether you're looking at sophisticated chemical materials or new chemicals. And I think the reality is that it seems to be increasingly an outdated regulatory framework that just cannot keep up with the pace of innovation and the pace of technology. And there are a number of people that are looking actively at how you would reform that. One of the specific issues with Tosca, and it also applies to looking at food additives, is this issue of physical form. So Tosca as a regulation was built up on the idea that you can identify something by its chemical identity. Chemistry is everything. Chemistry under Tosca is what drives the regulatory process. So if you throw something in there where physical form is a more important factor determining impact than chemistry, Tosca begins to break apart at the seams. And there are certain ways in which you can bend it over to actually deal with those different physical forms. The end of the day, it's very, very hard to do with the current structure. And so the only way beyond that is to develop a new regulatory structure which recognizes the importance of physical form as well as chemistry. Exactly the same.
Can you take a comment from the phone line?
Yeah, sure.
Yes, I had one question or comment. Someone mentioned non-engineered nanomaterials, and the thing that immediately came into my mind was diesel exhaust, which consists of a certain fraction of diesel exhaust would consist of nanoparticles. And it reminded me that the American Conference of Governmental Industrial Hygienists a few years ago had an exposure limit for diesel exhaust based on elemental carbon, the same parameter that NIOSH is suggesting for carbon nanotubes. And here is an exposure, okay, to a certain portion of nanoparticles, which is an occupational exposure, which has been around for a number of years, and there is no good exposure limit for diesel exhaust for occupational exposure. The American Conference of Industrial Hygienists withdrew its limit. So that's what popped into my mind when you talked about non-engineered nanoparticles.
Yeah, and I think there's still a lot of interest and a lot of uncertainty over things such as diesel particulate, especially where there's the possibility of getting size-related effects depending on whether you're looking at the fresh particulate or whether you're looking at it in its aggregated or aged state. Exactly the same applies to things such as welding fume, where again you've got primary particles which are in the nanoscale and then they aggregate up. And they change over time as they age. And although anecdotally there's evidence that the small stuff from welding fume and the fresh stuff is actually more serious from a health perspective than the aged stuff, there has been very little progress in terms of actually picking that apart and monitoring what might be a more appropriate exposure.
Thank you.
So I think we're going to lose our phone line here in just a few minutes. So we can continue to take questions from the room, but I just wanted to thank our presenter, Dr. Maynard, for his time preparing and for sharing his presentation with us today, and have this conclude our internet session. And thank you for your participation, and please remember to fill in your evaluation forms.